St George's, Low Middleton. A low ancient church which has yet to be connected to electricity, St George's occupies a lovely position on a slight rise above fertile fields and the River Tees, although not everyone has been so kind about it. One vicar said that all of the churches in County Durham, it was one of the very smallest and most despicable, perhaps the very meanest and most beggarly. There has been a church on this sacred spot since about 800 AD, when it served the villages of West Hartburn, Low Middleton and Over Middleton. The first two were deserted in medieval times. Perhaps it is possible to make out the make-up of Low Middleton in the fields beneath the church. And Over Middleton has been renamed Middleton Wunrow. The church was rebuilt and renamed in the 13th century, when there was a fashion for naming things after St George. Two medieval stone heads remain from its earliest days. One is a woman with her tongue sticking out, and she looks across the chancel arch to a man baring his teeth. This church, as well as ministering to the long-lost villagers, served the squires of Low Middleton Hall, the Killinghalls, Pembertons and Cox. The last squire was Henry Cox, who founded the railside ironworks that exploded into the new village of Middleton St George. The population grew so rapidly that Squire Cox paid for a new one, dedicated to St Lawrence, to be built in 1871 near the homes of the ironworkers. This must have delighted the vicar, the Reverend Towne, who stopped holding services in the old church that was fast tumbling down. Squire Cox whipped up a petition calling on him to restart services. But in the new St Lawrence Parish magazine, the vicar wrote, "I never listen to gossip, or to vague reports, or to the stories of professional mischief makers." He said the petition had been signed by 51 people who had no place signing such a petition. "For instance, it is simply an act of impertinence on the part of such persons as Bird or Wilson, utter strangers, or Barker, a non-resident Methodist, to meddle in the matter." He wrote, "I pass my pen at once through such signatures." So he struck out seven signatures as being those of strangers. He struck out another 18 as they hadn't attended church for years. He struck out another 11 as they had never attended church. And he struck out a further 12 as they attended the Methodist church, which left just three names. And he said it wasn't worth his while holding a service in St George's for them. But Squire Cox persevered. In 1884, he built a tower on the church. In 1888, he installed a window in memory of his parents, Eliza and Patience Cox. And in 1889, he had it restored and reseated, which suggests, in the end, he must have got his own way. He died in 1894, aged 89, an unmarried bachelor, although village gossip suggests he had 11 or more children with various village women. His obituaries sniggered about how lusty Squire Cox had been. Reports of his death also don't mention where he was buried, and strangely, he has no known grave. Village gossip says he was buried illegally inside the church alongside centuries of his ancestors. During the Second World War, his low tower on the church became a welcome landmark to airmen returning to RAF Middleton St George, as the bombers' dispersal pads on the end of the runway practically abutted the churchyard wall. The tower became unsafe and was removed in 1960, although its outline can still be seen.
the tea in China. This is an article from Living magazine. Since the 1820s, Britain has had an identity as a nation of tea drinkers. However, in the decades after tea arrived on our shores, round about 1650, it was a highly prized commodity, a value reflected in the tea caddies used to house it. Tea and tea drinking originated in China during the Tang Dynasty from AD 618 to 906, but arrived in Britain in the mid-17th century on the ships of the Dutch East India Company, and thus its history is inextricably linked with the history of porcelain, sugar, and even opium. At first, it was shipped in small quantities, commanding very high prices, and drunk with great ceremony in the homes of high society, or in the already popular coffee houses, where it cost 10 times more than the coffee itself. Needing to be kept safe and dry, it was kept in porcelain canisters, often blue and white, and resembling ginger jars, imported from the tea's homeland of China. The drink was made fashionable by the Portuguese wife of Charles II, Catherine of Braganza, when she came to Britain in 1662. But by the end of the 17th century, it was still only being drunk by the upper echelons of society. However, at the beginning of the 18th century, it began to arrive in significant quantities on large ships and was soon filtering down to the middle classes. Still a very expensive commodity and highly taxed, it needed careful and secure storage, and the tea caddy was born, a lockable container, smart enough to be in pride of place in a drawing room as a status symbol, the key kept by the lady of the house to prevent theft by the servants. The word caddy, however, was not coined until around 1800 and was derived from the Malay word kati, the Chinese pound, and the quantity in which tea was often sold. Before this date, the term canister was mostly used. Caddies began to be produced in all manner of fine materials, from silver and tortoise shell to ivory, papier-mâché, and figured woods such as mahogany and rosewood. Often highly decorated with inlaid details or chased scenes, they were made in a plethora of forms. While earlier examples were made as a single caddy, by the middle of the 18th century, they were often made in pairs, or with two containers in a single caddy for black and green tea and a little bowl for sugar, although for decades it was erroneously thought to be a mixing bowl. Leading makers such as Chippendale and Hepplewhite made fine examples, and tea and tea caddies flourished throughout the 18th century. A change was in sight, however, as tea began to be grown in British India in great quantities. By the start of the 19th century, tea became more widely available, less expensive, and a regular grocery item, and so fine tea caddies became less popular and slowly dwindled. Today, tea caddies are still a popular category at auction, but the market is somewhat changed from their heyday in the 1980s and 1990s. Some of the most highly prized today are fine silver examples, both those made by leading silversmiths working in Britain, such as Paul de Lamery from 1688 to 1751, and Chinese silver examples made specifically for export to the West. also popular are turned wood caddies in the form of fruit. Once worth thousands in the 1980s, they were widely faked, leading to a drop in the market. But good examples can still be found. Just be sure to purchase from a reputable auction house. With such variety in both form and price, tea caddies are an intriguing and often affordable way to start collecting antiques.
Does This Ring Any Bells? By Sarah Walker, D&S Times. I had a bit of a to-do yesterday when I was walking a dog on a path that was shared between pedestrians and cyclists. The dog, let's call him Fido, is young and led by his nose, which means that he is genetically programmed to not walk in a straight line. He zigzags with every fascinating scent that lands in his nostrils, which is about once every 10 seconds. He is also strong, so I am dragged about on the end of his lead like a ribbon hanging from a kite. Please note, I walk other people's dogs, so I'm not responsible for the lack of doggy decorum. Yesterday, captivated by an irresistible whiff, Fido suddenly pulled to the right, and of course I went with him. At that, the noise of screeching brakes and skidding tyres came from behind as we stepped into the path of a bicycle. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and because it was raining and I had my hood up, I had not heard him coming. As a cyclist myself, if I am approaching a dog walker, I slow down, ring my bell several times, and as I pass, thank the thoughtful owners for bringing their hounds under control. If we respect other path users, then we can all enjoy our outing, however we may be transporting ourselves. Sadly, not everyone thinks the same, with some cyclists pedalling as if they are trying to win a sprint at the Tour de France, and walkers who believe that their dogs running dangerously loose in front of them is a hazard not of their making. I like to think I am a responsible walker and make a point of gathering in loose pooches at the approach of anything on wheels. Dogs, and animals in general, are unpredictable and can be spooked into bolting by things unseen or noises unheard. I have to admit that I was in a bit of a grump yesterday, and one of my bugbears is cyclists not using their bells to warn you that they are approaching from behind. I did apologise for stepping into his path, but explained that I did not hear him coming. When he grumpily moved past us, I mumbled, "If you'd rung your bell, I'd have heard you." Seconds later, he stopped again and gave me such a dirty look that it lit a touch paper within me. "He's a dog. He moves about. How can I move out of your way if I can't hear you coming?" I asked angrily. That sparked a heated debate about whether it was a cycle path or a footpath. It was both. And why he should get a bell when he said most people can't hear him anyway. And why was I being so miserable? The funny thing is, I started to giggle inwardly at the ridiculousness of it all, and chastised myself for my rash response that triggered the confrontation. If I had said nothing, he would have simply cycled on, and we both would have been a bit annoyed, but that's all. It reminded me of a course I was sent on for work many years ago. The tutor asked why, when we get behind the wheel of a car, we transform from calm, rational individuals into reactive, fist-waving banshees. She reminded us that the person at whom we are gesticulating could have a machete in their glove box. If someone annoys you, it is much safer to curse inwardly at them and send them a choice manual greeting from below the cover of the dashboard. This was in the late 1990s, around the same time that the ruthless gangster Kenneth Noy was convicted of the fatal stabbing of a 21-year-old Stephen Cameron after a road rage incident on an M25 slip road. Whatever happened to spark the fight, it cannot have been worth a young man losing his life. It demonstrates that you have no idea who the opposing driver might be. Thanks to that tutor's wise words, I became far more tolerant behind the wheel. I was forced to admit to myself that I am not a perfect driver, that I too make mistakes, and occasionally might annoy other road users with a selfish manoeuvre. Despite that, I always make sure my bicycle bell works.
That brings to an end this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper. My thanks to all involved in this week's production. So to Bruce and Liz, the readers, to Dave and Margaret, the editors, and to Kate for the What's On guide. Don't forget, we love to hear from you with any comments you have regarding the recordings. Do give us a call on Darlington 465 101. Leave a message if no one's in the office. And of course, someone will get back to you. So I'm not back till August. Jed is with you next week. Until then, take care. Look after yourselves from me, Richie Hawkins, and all the team. It's bye-bye for now.